for the organizers to invite me and to give me an opportunity to talk about soy organisms. I basically will focus on three questions or three issues in this talk. The first, how does urban soy biota altered as a result of urban land use change, whether or not these changes in community structure translate to functional changes, and whether or not we have enough knowledge to put that into use in soil restoration and better management practices. Oops, well, that works too. I would like to start with the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment and their definition or their characterization of ecosystem services. They put, in general, not just for soil biota, they put these services into four major categories: supporting, provisioning, regulating, and cultural services, and give an additional list of the various processes and various services that they can provide fundamentally for human well-being. This, as you can see, highlighted in green are all those processes in which soy organisms are involved directly or indirectly, which is, as you can see, are almost all of them. Today, I would like to talk to only two of these services, the cultural and the supporting services. The supporting services fundamentally deal with issues of decomposition and nutrient transformations, and obviously soy organisms are a key in these processes. The provisioning services are something that really the rest of this conference should be talking about, and probably they are. And regulating services are just something that has not been studied in urban environment. So the previous speakers already talked abundantly about the massive changes that take place, initially massive disturbances, and also from that on when the land is converted to urban land use. And obviously for soy organisms, the most important is the, in terms of physical disturbance, is the loss of soil horizons and soil sealing, which disrupts, even for endogeic species, this is a significant change, disrupts the connection between the below ground and the atmosphere. But as Rich was mentioning, even in places where no massive physical disturbance took place, such as in remnant forest, you see a lot of changes related to, a lot of changes related to soil characteristics, and I just listed a few. Not all of them are necessarily disadvantageous for or stressful for soil organisms. Now, if we want to look at how these changes affect soil biota, we can start with just looking at general changes to major functional groups. And there are many ways to characterize soil biota. One of them is to talk about soil ecosystem engineers, which are obviously larger organisms responsible for altering soil physical structure, biological regulators, which are organisms that regulate other organisms, and nematodes are a good example of that. And then chemical engineers, primarily microorganisms, which are the key player for chemical transformations, elemental transformations. And on this figure, I'm showing that they are fundamentally responsible for these processes, but all of them obviously has an effect on the other processes as well. In 2010, the EU issued a technical report for soil biodiversity, and in it they list how land use change, which I'm showing on this table, affects these three groups that I just mentioned. And as you can see, although initially there are some variability in terms of change when you convert, say, forest to grassland, but when you end up from grassland to cropland to urban land, it's really a dim picture. Everywhere the biodiversity declines, and with that comes a decline all those ecosystem services that I just listed in the first slide. So all of these regulation, decontamination, and so on is declining, and the soil becomes increasingly poor and not self-organizing and not functioning properly as a result of urban land use. So I would argue that this is definitely true for these massive changes that we heard, for instance, in the first talk when you were talking about, you know, impervious surfaces and buildings and so on. But it's not necessarily the situation is that bad. I also will show you some examples from Baltimore, where I work. And fundamentally, this is not necessarily all that bad and everywhere, is because we are talking about an extremely heterogeneous landscape, which the previous speakers also pointed out, in which you have a whole variety of land use types, mosaics of different types of vegetation affected by human disturbances and human management to different degrees. And that will be reflected on the structure and function of soil fauna as well. So as Rich pointed out, we talk about urban soil mosaic, which has many different reasons, from the underlying parent material in Baltimore, therefore the soil that's developing on that, down to the parcel level, the homeowner level. And I'm just showing one example from one neighborhood where we work. For instance, this is soil organic matter content, and these are single level homes. This is the area here, and the colors correspond to different soil organic matter content, the darker being more. And as you see in neighboring households, you have different colors which reflect how these different households manage their front yard and their backyard. This is a forested patch. So do these changes have effect on urban soil biodiversity? While the general answer to this question is yes, of course they do. If you compare it to some surrounding wildland, urbanization will result in a general reduction of species diversity, because the urban environment produces very strong filtering mechanisms which simply does not allow a large portion of the regional species pool to be able to survive in a city. But that's not necessarily the case, or the degree of it is actually depend upon what sort of land use you have before. So for instance, when you compare a wheat field, or I think that's what it was we just saw in Ohio, to a suburban land, over time, this suburban landscape might actually harbor more species and more diverse fauna than the previous intensively agricultured cropland. It also depends on the taxa. I mean, different groups of organisms respond to these changes very differently. And I'm going to show you one example of that. This comes from a very old, relatively old study from Europe, from Warsaw, where people have a very good knowledge, scientists have very good knowledge of what is the regional species pool. This is endemic species to the region. And conducted a study for a whole array of soil organisms, not just soil organisms, but that's what I'm showing you, of what percent of the species pool actually survives in the cities. And this is data I compiled for many papers for, these are all arthropods, different arthropod groups. And what you see here, plotted here, is the percentage of the species of the fauna, of percentage of the number of species which are remaining in the city and plotted as a function of species pool. And what you can see here is obviously these numbers vary a great deal between like 20 and 80%. Just look at the light squares right now, or diamonds. And you can also see is that really very groups that are very rich in species, such as ground beetles and spiders, they tend to lose a larger percentage of their original fauna than groups which have fewer species to begin with. And you can understand that biologically, because these groups probably have a lot of rare or very sensitive species which just simply doesn't make it in the city. What you can also see here, though, is that when you include suburbia into this analysis, the suburban environments actually provide a suitable habitat for a lot more species than just the inner city parks and other green spaces. So it depends on the taxa to a great deal. Now, the total diversity in a city can actually be larger than the surrounding area, and that could be because the number of non-native species, as Rich was mentioning, can also be high. And he showed you some graphs, and I'm just going to briefly show you. These are our data for a number of macrofauna groups from urban and rural forests. And as you see, the number of non-native species can vary between 0 and 100%, and that's just because, again, the natural history and also the human history and how easy things are transportable and so on for different group of organisms. Now, sometimes maybe the species richness doesn't change, but the relative abundance of certain species changes. So this is a study from Denmark, from a city in Denmark, and this is a typical what we call rank abundance diagrams, when you rank the species based upon their abundances, and here are their actual abundances. This is on log scale. And so species which are up here are the most abundant. And what you can see here, each species is designated by different symbols. So if you just look at this, you can see that as you move from the rural to suburban to urban, this particular species of isopods, which is a cosmopolitan species, becomes more and more dominant. So species composition can change in terms of certain more sort of synanthropic species becoming more dominant. And the question is, does that matter in terms of the function that species, that these different organisms play in the soil ecosystem? Well, generally speaking, we consider soil biota to be functionally redundant, which means that because there's a lot of species living in the soil, it's relatively okay to use a few of them, or species can replace each other in terms of the function. So the function of the soil, whatever you define as a function is, may not change tremendously even if species composition change. And again, this is because we have a lot of species, and so one can sort of replace the other one. Now, there are some situations when this is not necessarily the case. Obviously, if you're looking at keystone species and you're losing that from your system, then your system will suffer. Or groups which have low dispersal rates. And you can imagine if you have these different mosaics of different types of land uses and land covers, if you lose, something happens here, and you have species with low dispersal rates, it's very difficult for those to sort of recolonize those patches. And many soil organisms, or most of them, are very poor dispersers. If you have functional groups which are fundamentally don't have a lot of species, earthworms is a good example of that. Again, this replacement might not be easy, and obviously if you have sensitive species, that could be an issue as well. So I'm going to show you two examples when species composition change translates actually to function or ecosystem service. The first, as Rich was mentioning, is coming from the earthworms. And earthworms are generally known to stimulate nitrogen cycling by probably indirectly stimulating the microbes that are doing or responsible for these nitrogen transformations. However, there is a great deal of difference on species level of how well or the degree of this stimulation. And Rich was mentioning Asian and European species, and we did a study in which we compared the effect of three relatively large species on nitrogen mineralization and nitrification. And what you can see here is that these Asian species, both when we take soil from where it lives and also when we do laboratory incubations, which we start out with the same soil, have a much stronger effect in terms of producing inorganic nitrogen. And so what that means is that if once this species replaces either of those, then you will have probably an effect which will manifest itself even on the ecosystem level. The other one is a study that was done in Baltimore looking at carrion beetles, and people may not want to look at these pictures, but anyway, their function is basically very small vertebrate dead bodies, small birds or mammals or reptiles, because that's what provides food for their developing larvae. And the study looked at whether or not these beetles performed this study and found that they performed this study if there is sufficient forest cover in the landscape. If the forest cover drops down to 15, 20, 15% lower, and in addition, the surrounding context is fundamentally urban, even though you find the beetles there, they do not perform this ecosystem service. And even though you find them, what that means is that they're just probably transient members of the fauna, but they're not functioning there the way they are supposed to. We also heard about salt use previously, and salting is very negatively affecting soil fauna, as you can see here for this particular springtail species, affecting negatively their survival and, more importantly, their reproductive rate. Here, salt concentration is replaced or shown, electrical conductivity is shown as a proxy. And similarly, with this earthworm species, this is changing weight over time. This is controlled, increasing salt use, and as you can see, they're losing weight and eventually they die. And I just want to mention that this particular species is one of the hardiest, most widely distributed, very highly tolerant species to all kinds of environmental conditions. This is an endogeic species living in the soil, and yet it is affected negatively with salt. Now, this can be only an issue in wintertime, at least where we live, when people use a lot of salt, but these organisms are active, not too active, but they are active in winter, so they are negatively affected by that as well. The other management effect I would like to mention, obviously, is lawn care. And in this case, we did a study in the previously mentioned neighborhood looking at microarthropod abundances as a function of lawn care, which is indicated in this case, the number of fertilizers, the number of times fertilizers were used in these different lawns. And as you can see, they are very highly affected, probably indirectly, by this fertilizer use, which either affects root growth or fungal growth or something like that. And we found this not just for springtails, but for mites as well in this study. Now, one ecosystem service that the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment doesn't mention, because it's not directly related to human well-being, is that these organisms are food for vertebrate and invertebrate predators. Now, many studies all of the speakers talked about heavy metal pollution and the higher heavy metal concentration in urban soils, and our study is not different from that. This is a plot level, household level study that we conducted some years ago, and what you can see here, again, as we move from the urban to the rural areas, heavy metals do decline. This is on a log scale, I guess, so we're talking about changes in orders of magnitude. Now, this pattern actually does show up in the body concentration of soil organisms, as you can see here for both earthworms and isopods, which are the two most abundant groups of soil invertebrates. And as you see, in both cases, you have a higher lead concentration in urban areas. That then cascades into the higher trophic level. The same households or the same residences were sampled for bird songbird blood level. And again, as you can see, both for migratory birds and resident birds, there was higher lead concentration in urban birds than in rural birds. Now, this might not be, people don't really care about how much lead is in worms and so on, but people do care about songbirds. And so we generally consider urban areas good for birds because we feed them, and so these very high, you know, self-sustaining populations of these birds. We feed them, we provide them a shelter and nesting sites and so on, but they may not be as healthy as birds in rural areas. Another sort of ecosystem service that relates to, in this case, zinc pollution is bioturbation performed by earthworms. And I didn't know that until I was involved in this study, but I do know that now that today a major source of zinc pollution in cities comes from tire wear, a deposition of roadway dust, which obviously ends up with the runoff in some areas. In this case, in the University of Maryland campus, these bioretention ponds were built where all the dust, all the runoff from the parking lot was collected into these ponds. And so it's deposited on the soil surface. And what earthworms do, which surprisingly live in these ponds, I was very surprised with all the salts and everything, is that over even a six-week period, the amount of zinc dust is decreasing, presumably because of the earthworm effect, or at least they facilitate this. They are being, you know, turned into deeper soil layer. And more importantly, they also increase the bioavailability, probably, again, facilitating some microbial process of these things so that the plants can take up this heavy metal. Now, so these are all services related to nutrient transformations and so on. Do these organisms provide any cultural services? And this is the list of the four possible services that's listed in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And I mean, I would be hard pressed to find examples when people find, you know, aesthetic pleasure or some kind of spiritual inner peace or something like that by looking at bugs and worms. And they usually don't. But I would argue that educational services, at least potentially, are tremendous. I have been involved in teacher workshops and hosted various inner city youth groups and participated in bio blitzes and other sort of public outreach and education programs. And I always found that people are very receptive to learning about the organisms in the soil. They're learning about their role in the soil. Most of the time, they don't know anything about them. And even in some cases, get excited about looking at them and sometimes even handling them. And so I think this is an actually important of the 22 or of the 25?
Two minutes left.
Okay. So this is a potentially important venue for us to educate people, and so that can lead to maybe better management of the soil as well. So that leads us to restoration. So organisms, so how do we restore soil biota? We normally don't. I don't have time to talk about this, but generally in the cities, on the one end of the spectrum, we have these self-assembling communities, like the vacant lots when there's no human involvement. On the other end, there is what we call facilitated assembly, when people are 100% determining, like in a landscape area, what kind of plants go in there. And so soil organisms tend to sort of be in the self-assembly side, or primarily they move around passively, they move around with the soil. Partially, we don't know what's exactly we want to be there, and secondly, it's very difficult to manage soil organisms in that way. But there are other sort of ways of promoting a healthy soil biota, and the previous speaker talked about that. One of them is obviously restoring the food web. This is a decomposer food chain, and the basis of that is plant detritus, leaf litter, glass clipping, and trees, which we always remove. So just by changing that, we can increase tremendously both abundance and species richness of these biota, and so definitely education is the key to that. So in summary, although this highly altered soil biota, there's a great deal of variation. They do provide and should provide the same ecosystem services related to all retaining the carbon and not, you know, being carbon being lost from the system. They are important in building up carbon in urban environments on the long-term storage. And then definitely that is important to educate people, which can then lead to these restoration activities. And with that, I would like to acknowledge all the collaborators and thanks for your attention.
We have one.
1 minute before the next speaker, so probably one question, I think, for Dr. Slavitz.
There was one slide, and I'm not sure I understood it, but were you looking at the, I think, the spring cells and how the level of lawn management
yes.
affected that? I didn't quite understand. It looked like there was more spring cell
in the high
variable when they're at the higher level.
Yes. So it's like I said, it's hard to say. It's probably what happens. It might promote primary productivity. Springtails are primarily fungal feeders. So if you have more lawn, maybe you have more root biomass or more fungal biomass.